It's Lars. Thank you for checking out my podcast, and have a great day.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll get back to your phone calls and your emails a bit later. You can always vote in our Twitter poll, at Lars Larson Show, and if you can't stand Twitter, vote in on the website at LarsLarson.com. I hear Mark Mills laughing in the background. Mark Mills, and boy, this guy wears all kinds of hats. Senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, which I've always found to be very instructive to read everything that comes out of Manhattan Institute. Faculty fellow at Northwestern University's McCormick School of Engineering and Applied Science, and co-director of the Institute on Manufacturing Science and Innovation, and a strategic partner with Cottonwood Venture Partners. So he's got the education, he's got a foot in academe, he's got a foot in actually applying science to stuff that actually helps us, and then he's got a hand in, or a wallet in, or a checkbook in, actually making these things happen with the money. You've got it all covered, except do you show up on the factory floor and run a CNC machine or anything like that?
Well, you know, back in my impetuous youth, I actually did was a machinist and weld, learned to weld, and I was a motorcycle mechanic. I raced Grand Prix as a foolish youth motorcycles. So I've tried everything. This is a great version of tried a little bit of everything, not very good at anything.
Well, I'll have to make it clear. There is a famous Lars Larson who uses two S's in his last name, who is a motocross racer. I think he's still actually doing it in his 80s, but I am not that guy, although I learned his name when I was 11. I was working on my bike when I had a dirt bike, and I walked into the motorcycle shop, and they you know, back in those days, they had to write out the receipt, and they said, "What's your name?" And I said, "Lars Larson." And they looked at me and said, "You are not Lars Larson." I had no idea what they were talking about, but I later learned that I had a doppelganger who shared my name, but was much better at riding a dirt bike than I was. I want to talk to you about the science of the Green New Deal and the science of any of the proposals to replace the energy that we depend on with some kind of green alternatives, because you've written some great pieces recently that talk about the fact that as much as people may love the idea, and I know that their heart is where it should be, that's where the liberals go with this, their heart says we should all be able to get by on solar and wind, the math and the science doesn't work. So now that I've given all of your CV and people know how qualified you are, does the science of the Green New Deal actually work, Mark?
Well, it doesn't work the way they think it works. It works in ways that they probably, if they thought about it, wouldn't be happy about. So it's, you know, people think that there's some magic unobtainium. I've used this line before, as you probably know, that exists when it comes to energy, that, you know, electric car, everyone has pointed out the obvious, you have to plug it in. Well, that's the least relevant thing about electric cars. You have to make the batteries with something. And we'll start with the batteries and the science of energy systems. There's no, to use the old physics adage, there's no free lunch, right? And but that,
right.
I mean, energy, in fact, itself is free. We had nothing to do with the energy resources in the world, oil, gas, coal, the sun, wind. We didn't create them. We had nothing to do with them. They're just there. The energy that we use to operate our society all comes from building machines that convert a natural free resource into something useful. So everything about the physics of energy is anchored into the machines you have to build, which all wear out, because all machines wear out, which means none of them are renewable. Everything wears out. Everything has to be replaced. And it's how much stuff do you have to dig out of the earth to build those machines? That's what matters. So factoid we could start with. The battery in a typical electric car, which most people don't realize, weighs about 1,000 pounds. 1,000 pounds. That's your fuel tank. Pretty big battery. That's why you have to use aluminum and fiber composites to lightweight the rest of the car to make room for the 1,000 pounds of battery. But it requires something on the order of 500,000 pounds of earth materials to be dug up to build just one battery.
And by the way, the machines that do that have to be built from materials that we mine, and they have to have fuel. And I would imagine at this point, nobody is doing mining. I know that some mining machines run on electricity, some of the bigger earth-moving, you know, stationary things. But when you're talking about taking 50 trucks that will carry 50 ton of ore out of a mine, they don't have an electric version of that yet, right?
Well, the electric versions exist in principle. They don't work very well because batteries are not very good for long range and heavy lift. So you're right. 99%+ of the energy used to dig up stuff from the earth are oil-fired giant machines made by famous companies like Caterpillar and John Deere and Kubota, different. So here's a factoid for you. The point, when you got out of that one issue, what most people don't realize, the quantity of oil that the global mining industry uses today rivals the quantity of oil that the global aviation industry used before we shut the world down. It's an extraordinary amount of oil used to dig that stuff up. And the Green New Deal path, no matter what form it takes, whether it's the Biden-Harris form, the AOC form, Germany's form, it makes no difference. That path will lead to an increase in global mining, the biggest in the history of the world.
And by the way, Mark, can you reflect on, I've shared this with my audience before, because I'm taking this from a much more simple level than you are. I want to talk about the batteries. But when it comes to, they say, we'll just have everybody buy electric cars. And I looked up the number. Last year, a little less than 250,000 electric cars sold in America. And they say, that's a lot. I said, no, yeah. Americans bought 16 million gasoline and diesel-powered cars. So if we could quadruple the number of electric cars sold next year, 2021, it would take 250 years at a million a year to replace. If you did it at the current rate, it would take a millennia to replace. And they say, oh, no, we'll ramp up to 6 or 8 million. I said, oh, well, then it'll only take 40 years to if we force people to buy those vehicles. The math doesn't work there on the commercial end of things either, does it?
Well, you've just committed a major sin. You've actually done arithmetic. Arithmetic. So I mean, you know, we talk about illiteracy. There's also innumeracy. You obviously don't suffer from the latter, but well, you're absolutely right. So the scale issue is what matters. Let me do your numbers differently.
All right.
There are about a million electric cars in the United States now. There's a surprising number of them, and you're right. So that sounds like a lot until you look at the fact there's 250 million registered vehicles in America.
Yep.
So they account for 0.5%. of the vehicles in America at the moment. The world has 5 million electric vehicles, which is a lot more than there were 10 years ago. So it's really quite something. I think this is all due to Elon Musk, by the way. It's due to two people, the inventor of the lithium chemistry back in the late 70s, which was, by the way, an Exxon researcher, sort of ironic. The invention of lithium chemistry and Elon Musk, you know, Elon Musk did an amazing job of promotion, both in getting credits and, of course, of building cars and a brand. And he's caused the whole world to decide they can have electric cars. But here is, to use a popular phrase these days, here's the deal. Here's the deal. If we get to 500 million electric cars in the world, a 100-fold increase in 20 years,
I'm talking to Mark Mills. You'll find his work at the Manhattan Institute. He's also at Northwestern University and with Cottonwood Venture Partners. We'll be back in just a moment to continue this great conversation. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Yeah. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's a real pleasure to have Mark Mills with me from Northwestern University, from the Manhattan Institute. He's a venture partner, a venture capital guy who actually takes the science he knows and then applies it to actually turn into things we need. He co-founded Digital Power Capital, which was a venture capital firm, and was chairman of CTO ICX Technologies. We've been talking about the sort of the impracticalities of the Green New Deal, and we started out with vehicles. Before we leave vehicles altogether, can you speak to this? I love following a Twitter account called Babylon Bee, which is a Christian based, but they do parodies.
Correct.
And they have Gavin Newsom in one recently where it says, governor of state with no electricity suggests everybody drive an electric car. And of course, an awful lot of their parody, they don't even have to work hard to get to there, because all of us have been saying, if you want us to be driving electric cars, and Americans are buying 16 million gas and diesel cars and a quarter of a million electric cars, and you want that jumped up to 5 or 10 million cars a year, where are we going to get the juice? And I get the answer back from a lot of liberals. I hate to say it, but it's very simplistic. It's like a child's understanding of something. If daddy needs more money, you just go to the ATM and it hands you money. If you need electricity, you just plug it into the wall and the electricity is there. Have they figured out Have we confronted a notion that if almost a third of America's electric car, a power of our grid nationwide comes from coal, and a certain percentage from nat gas, which the greenies also hate, and then a certain percentage from nuclear, which they won't even consider as one of the replacement sources, and that we're tearing out dams, to some extent we're reducing hydro, and certainly not advancing any new hydro, where the heck is the juice going to come from to make these cars run?
Well, at a kind of circular argument, the serious greens claim that we'll build lots more windmills and solar arrays, and of course, everyone knows the sun and wind don't appear all the time. So what you'll do in their world vision is build lots more, you can guess it, batteries to store the electricity on the grid for when you need it to charge your battery powered car. That's the concept, the vision, which has been seriously proposed. But let's be clear about one thing: it isn't impossible to do that. It's just nuts. I mean, you can do a lot of things. So it's not impossible to build enough batteries. It's just crazy. And let me give you an idea how crazy it is at the grid scale. So you put your finger on something. You plug a car into the grid. You're charging whatever the average electricity is. In America, that's roughly 70% either a combination of coal and natural gas. Slightly more natural gas than coal nationally. Depends where you live. And then, you know, as you pointed out, about 20% nukes. So on the margin, you have this 8% that's wind and solar, and the rest is the stuff that nobody likes in the green community. They want to change that, and they want to store the electricity in batteries. Here, I'm going to use the expression again. Here's the deal. Imagine that the wind doesn't blow for a day or two.
Yeah.
Be calm. It happens all the time for a day or two. Imagine there's no significant sunlight for a day or two, including when there's forest fires in the daytime or rain, which happens all the time. You'd have to store roughly 2 days' worth of electricity in batteries if that's what your plan is to do. How many batteries does that represent? That run back to your arithmetic, which is actually important to use. So the biggest battery factory in America, and still the biggest one in the world, is Elon Musk's Gigafactory in Nevada. It makes all the batteries for Teslas. It's a massive factory. You see pictures of it. If you use a magic Google machine to look at drone pictures of it, it's enormous, much bigger than many shopping malls combined. The output of that one factory, this billion-dollar-plus factory, it would have to operate for 500 years to produce enough batteries for 2 days of the grid storage.
So, all right, then, since you're a technical guy, let me ask you about something else, and that is pumped storage, because I hear people say, well, it doesn't all have to be batteries. We can pump water uphill and it'll run down. I said, yeah, there are utilities that do that for peaking power right now. But it's also, one, expensive. Two, you can't do it in every geography because some geography lends itself. Northern California, I think, has a couple of these where they have a convenient hill nearby, maybe even a lake. They pump a bunch of water up when the energy is somewhat cheaper at night, and then they let it run downhill when everybody turns on their blow dryers and their toaster ovens to make breakfast, and they get some peaked storage, but it's hugely expensive. And I also have to tell them, you know, and again, this is where I'm weaker, Mark. All the laws of thermodynamics that say when we take electricity and put it into a motor to run a pump, to pump water uphill, there's loss in every one of those. When we run the water back downhill and it runs through another reverse pump, basically a Pelton wheel or something, into a generator, there's more loss there. And then when we transmit it a couple of hundred miles to wherever the electricity, there's loss there. And then when we put it into a charger, there's some loss there. And then it goes into a battery that you may put 10 kilowatt into, but you don't necessarily get 10 kilowatt out. Whereas when I put 10 gallons of gas in my gas tank, I get 10 gallons worth of fuel. You don't get that with a... Can you speak to some of these loss issues? Because I know they may get a little thick for some people and some people's eyes glaze over, but I think they're actually important because they say, well, we'll just pump storage. And you say, but A, the capital cost, B, the losses.
Well, you know, Shazam, Gomer, y'all just did a high school physics lesson. That's good. Well, that's good. You nailed it. Look, all energy transformations cost energy. So that's the way of saying that, as you pointed out, they have losses. You can't, this is a basic law of thermodynamics. You're absolutely right. You convert energy from one form to another, you lose energy in that process. It's always the case. It's impossible to avoid in the universe we live in. So you're right. Pump storage has that problem. All storage has that problem. The least energy costly storage is storing oil in a tank. It's just flat out the least, maybe no, that's not true. The least costly storage is a pile of coal sitting in a coal yard. That's very cheap in energy in dollar terms. The most costly storage, at the far end of the spectrum, are batteries. But you're right. You have an energy cost. It's roughly 20% of your energy is lost in the round trip of making electricity, put water up a hill, and bring it back down and make it electricity. So it's you can maybe, you know, get systems that are 10 or 15% thrown away, but that's a rule of thumb. So you have losses. But the biggest problem is the one you put your finger on, is that you don't have many places where there's useful pumped hydro. Pumped hydro means you have to have a high head, a long way up from the where you're pumping the water from to, because you need gravity to pull it back down. You need a long distance to get the energy recovered. So there aren't many big hydro dams where you can do this in the world, and the ones that we've built are probably the only ones we're ever going to build, none of the environmental community, and most people don't want to build more hydro dams. And there aren't many places to build them in America now anyway. So it's not a solution broadly for the country. It's not even an expandable solution for California because they want to tear hydro dams down. But the energy cost of batteries, incidentally, is similar. You roughly throw away 10 or 20% of the energy round trips, depending on the battery, depending how you charge it. And some batteries are a little better. Some might only have, you know, 8 or 9% thrown away. But you're using energy to store energy. But here's another part of the hidden use of energy to store energy. It takes energy to fabricate a steel tank to store oil, not a lot per unit of oil stored. It takes energy to fabricate a battery. It takes a lot. To build enough batteries that can store the equivalent of one barrel of oil, to build that many batteries requires consuming 100 to 300 barrels of oil of energy.
Wow.
To make the battery.
I'm talking to Mark Mills. We're going to be back in just a moment. Mark Mills is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, also at Northwestern University, at the McCormick School of Engineering, and, importantly enough, Applied Science. And we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with Mark Mills, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, faculty fellow at Northwestern University's McCormick School of Engineering and Applied Science. He's written a lot, and most recently I saw a piece that he'd done. He's on the show before, but Daily Caller piece, The Green New Deal Cannot Break the Laws of Physics. And so, Mark, you're telling us that even if, as you and I are talking today, Joe Biden is elected president, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the great scientist who graduated with an economics degree from Boston University, I'm being sarcastic, Boston University, that even if we pour $93 trillion that we don't have into the Green New Deal, the math and the science of it does not work. So what can we tell the people who, look, I have no problem with solar. I actually use some solar, but I've told people I wouldn't use it till it penciled. And for most situations, most people, it doesn't pencil. And they say, what do you mean by that? And I said, well, if Mark Mills, you know, over at Northwestern offered to sell me a machine that made gasoline, I might be interested. But the minute he tells me that my capital and operating costs will mean that I'll be making gasoline at $10 a gallon out of his magic machine when I can buy it down the street for, even in the Pacific Northwest, $3 a gallon, I ain't going to buy the machine because it doesn't make financial sense. That's what I mean by penciling. Is there a way to make much of any of this actually pencil out?
Well, we know one answer is yes. As long as the government, using other people's money, hands you that $10 for each gallon, which is what's going on with subsidies. So if the market is giving you money that's courtesy of other people, it pencils out. But that's subsidy structure can't survive forever. It can survive for a while. We've been doing this for quite a few years. Europe is still doing it. So the assertion is that this stuff, wind, solar, and batteries, are going to get so much cheaper that we won't have to subsidize them soon. We know that's not true, and the easy test for this is not a physics test. It's a political test. Every time anybody proposes to end the subsidies for wind and solar, you have never seen such a fusillade of lobbying in Washington to protect the subsidies. It is epic protection of these subsidies. This is the truth that we do know, is that Europe is further ahead of us in installing wind and solar combined on their grids. We also know that has directly led to the cost of electricity now being three times higher than America's in places like Germany. They triple the cost of American electricity outside of California. 300% increase as we add more wind and solar. It's a stunning cost. It's not cheap. It is cheaper than it used to be, and you're absolutely right. There are many places and significant applications globally, really tremendously significant applications globally for wind and solar. But it won't replace coal, oil, and gas at any time frames that have any meaning. And by that I mean not decades, probably centuries. That's just the reality of where we are. And this is not me saying it. Incidentally, the International Energy Agency, which is a full-on supporter and promoter of the Green New Deals and all their forms around the world, has a new forecast that came out with. And even in their most aggressive wish list forecasts, in the year 2040, oil, gas, and coal still provide 70% of the world's energy. That's hardly a transition.
No, it's not. And by the way, you've pointed out in some of what you've written, this is where we get into sort of the ugly side. You talked about the ugly side of all the mining that's required. Now, I don't have a problem with mining, but if somebody says 500,000 pounds, was it 500,000 pounds or tons of dirt that you have to move to get the material for one battery, you also point out that some of the key ingredients like cobalt come from some truly ugly parts of the world that do ugly things to children.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. I used to work for a mining company in my impetuous youth in Canada, and I like mining. I've been to the bottom of a 7,000-foot vertical shaft in the Granite Shield in northern Canada. It's pretty, really amazing what miners do. And we have no choice but to mine things. Everything on the planet, everything in society, everything we have is built from some minerals, materials we take out of the earth. And that's without exception, right? I mean, trees grow by extracting more efficiently than we do minerals and materials from the ground. That's how they grow.
Why we live in wood houses.
It's quasi-theological. It's really miraculous when you think about it. The minerals and the elements that we use to make all the magical things we have, you know, cobalt and these weird elements, you know, the rare earth dysprosium and neodymium, these cool names, they were forged in the heart of a star, you know, billions of years ago, and they never disappear. They're here forever, and we can reuse them over and over again. They really are recyclable in that sense. They last in the universe that we live in for essentially infinite time. It's just amazing. But it takes machines and energy to coax them out of the ground and the rocks where they're hidden and convert them into things. And unfortunately, a lot of mining around the world, in places like Congo, where roughly two-thirds, well, I think it's more like 60% now, 60% of the world's cobalt is mined in Congo. And Congo is notorious for having child labor, kids using shovels in hands and carrying bags of rocks. I mean, it really is despicable. And, the problem we've got is we don't have an easy mechanism. We can't go and take over the Congo and make them do things. If we demand more cobalt, and we won't mine it here, no one wants to do that in our political system, we'll be importing it from somewhere. And you can't easily have a conflict-free, remember conflict-free diamonds?
Oh, yeah.
It's very hard to make conflict-free minerals because the in economics, the word fungible, it's very fungible. You can't tell where the atoms came from in the end. And if we push demand as high as we're going to push demand with green deals, in fact, a number of the UN agencies have pointed out what they're worried about is a so-called gold rush for energy minerals going into fragile ecosystems around the world where there are weak legal and social protections against destroying the land and landscape. I would worry, too, if I were an environmentalist. I would think this, I am an environmentalist. Who isn't? I'm talking about the political environmentalists.
Right.
You should be worried about that. That's not a good thing. And if you really want green stuff here, my bottom line is very easy since it's a political season. For every extra dollar we want to subsidize a green machine, batteries, wind, solar, we should require one extra pound of minerals to be mined in America.
We actually have things like these rare earths. I always start with germanium and then I run out because my list in my head doesn't go that far. But let's say all the fancy stuff that makes your smartphone work and your fancy TV on the wall work, that comes from rare earths, which, as I understand, 90% comes from China. So if we truly embraced the Green New Deal, and said, okay, we're going to go wind, solar, lots of batteries, that by definition, because of the laws in the United States that are not likely to change, we're going to become much more dependent on communist China for all of this, right?
Well, and not just China, but also Russia and many African nations. Some of the nations that mine this stuff still and sell it to us are friendly to us, Australia and Canada. I'm Canadian. I like Canadian mines. But an awful lot of them aren't. One of the biggest nickel mines in the world is a Russian mine in Siberia. maybe the second largest nickel mine in the world. And they had a massive oil spill this past summer, the second biggest Arctic oil spill ever since the Exxon Valdez. Didn't make much news. Nobody cares. But in service of more nickel for making more batteries, nickel is a key element in batteries, we get it from there. The United States has always had massive mineral resources. The United States was the largest source of the rare earth elements in the world in the 90s. Rare earths are interesting, by the way. They aren't rare. They have rare properties. They're very common all over the world, but they just have rare properties. They make magnets extremely powerful. The rare earth element called neodymium makes magnets, and as does dysprosium, makes magnets able and motors able to handle far higher temperatures, which is important when you have a car and electric drives. We could mine more. We should mine more, and we need to mine more even if we don't have a Green New Deal, because we've become 100% dependent on imports for something like 20 of our key minerals that we need, and we get more than half of all of our key minerals by imports for like another dozen to two dozen.
Mark, it's been a pleasure. We're always glad to have you back, and thanks for the work you do both for the Manhattan Institute, the pieces you write for Daily Caller, and at Northwestern University's McCormick School of Engineering and Applied Science. Thanks very, very much, and we'll look forward to the next time you come on.
Thanks for having me. It's always fun to do a little science lesson with you. I'm glad you did a great job of thermodynamics for high schoolers. Thank you, Loris.
Thanks very much. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Yeah. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's a real pleasure to have Mark Mills with me from Northwestern University, from the Manhattan Institute, the average voter out there. And they hit me with questions all the time, and some of them I can answer, and some are at your level, and I couldn't begin to answer them. So this is so terribly important that we arm people up with these pieces of information. So when their friends start saying, well, I've got a Tesla or I've got a Leaf and it works great and everybody should have one, that I want people to be capable of not just saying, well, that's stupid, but saying, here's what you should understand went into that, that you don't even know went into it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I found most people that aren't zealots are receptive and they understand when you tell them facts. Especially if you tell them the facts in a sort of non-political way. This is not a red or green, a blue team versus issue. It's become red team, blue team, as you know. But
yep.
Where do you want to get the stuff? I mean, I like you said, I've said many speeches and places. I like windmills. I like electric cars. I think Tesla's impressive. Really good for him. I mean, the subsidy part I'm not happy about, but it's an impressive car. Give him credit.
Yeah.
And I'm delighted with the fact that I have a tech executive building machines. For goodness sake, all the rest of these dweebs are, mouth breathers doing Twitter. Come on. This is great. But
well,
the morality of it that offends me, and I, like you, have said many places I have to begin speeches by saying I'm not in opposition to a technology. I'm in opposition to the immorality of reverse Robin Hood. I'm in opposition to taking from the poor and giving to the rich. This offends me. I'm in opposition to enslaving children to serve, your smartphones. I just think this is terrible. We have, could you pay more for your smartphone battery? Sure, why not? I mean, the truth is the amount of cobalt you need for that is so small, you could triple the cost of cobalt. It wouldn't make any difference. But it sure would for a Tesla. I mean, these big batteries can't tolerate high mineral costs. So, now, I think it's important. It's a little disheartening when you look at the polling data, when you see that Republican millennials, 80% of them, want the government to do more subsidies for alternative energy and more about climate change. I mean, which explains why even our best allies in politics are very reluctant to take these issues on, because they know what the polls show. They want to just, the basic answer when I meet with these, their staff or some of them, is give me an answer, give me something I can do so I can look like I'm part of the solution for the problem. And they don't want to be told there isn't a problem with climate. They want to be told that they got a solution, which is why they support the subsidies, why it keeps happening. It'll keep happening too, unfortunately.
Can I ask you about two other things real quick? And I'll make them quick.
Sure.
A few years ago, I read about ammonia And there was somebody who was pushing the idea that on the Columbia River dams, that if you want a way to store, instead of using storage where basically you make the water levels go up and down the river, which everybody thinks doesn't cause a problem, it does cause problems with riverbank erosion and all kinds of things. And they said, you can take electricity and fairly readily turn it into ammonia. And what I didn't realize, you can run a diesel engine or a version of a diesel engine on ammonia. So you basically could have giant tanks full of ammonia that would then, when you need the power, run back through generators. And it would be a zero carbon storage system. Does that, and yet I tell people, if you don't see somebody using it on a big scale, there's likely a physics reason for it, like thorium reactors and why they're not being used. Does that stuff work? And is there any possible application where they say for a battery, we're going to just make ammonia? And I was amazed that you could burn ammonia in a diesel engine, but apparently you can.
Well, diesel engines are pretty magical. You can run a properly designed diesel almost any liquid that's combustible. It just has to have a flash point, and that's why, I've been doing some reading and some history for my next book, I did some reading of what Rudolf Diesel did and when he did it, and it was really quite a story. It really is, and it is a sad story because he built the world's first diesel engine. That's why it's named after him. But they didn't have materials that could stand the pressures needed, the temperatures, when he invented and built.
Oh, but we do now, don't we?
Well, it took 20 years before high-strength steel came along and people could build them, but his patent had expired by then, and he, I think, died a poor man.
You're
desolate.
Kidding.
And I mean, it was really pretty pathetic. But here's your instincts are correct. You can store electricity in a lot of intermediate forms easily. Storing it as electrons is hard, because those are capacitors, and they're the only way to store. Well, that's not true. You can store electricity in a superconducting coil, but you don't know enough about those costs to know that doesn't cost that pencil.
Doesn't make sense. Yeah.
But capacitors are the only things that store electricity as electrons. Otherwise, you have to make them into an intermediate form. You either make a chemical, you could heat something up, cool something down, create pressure, move water uphill, all these things. You got the Fred Flintstone solutions that you've seen going around where they want to use cranes to lift rocks up next to wind turbines and let them come down.
Well,
it's really nutty. But all of them have inefficiencies built into the process, conversion processes. So making chemicals is very chemical production is the most energy intensive industry in America. It's the largest consumer of industrial energy in the United States, bigger than steel. There's a reason for that. Making chemicals requires energy. So making ammonia consumes energy. So your round trip losses are extraordinarily high. The machinery is complex. And it's expensive, so it adds to the costs. So, another version of this, the simpler one, is people want to use wind turbines to make hydrogen by electrolyzing water when you don't need the wind electricity. So
right.
they operate in this theory, which is a pretty good theory. If I built a wind turbine and I'm being paid for its electricity for when it operates, and if that's sufficient to pay for the whole cost of the wind turbine.
Mark, it's been a pleasure. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you and always glad to get your calls. And it is First Amendment Friday. If you want to call into the show, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. And just a little while ago, a gentleman called me as a naysayer and he said, Lars, you need to tie all this together and tell everybody this is part of a long-running plot to take over America. And by this, he means the riots, the looting, the protests, the identity politics, and everything else. It's created an ugly scene in America, and it has the mob in the streets demanding that they be listened to and that the rest of us be ignored effectively, which I don't think makes any sense. But there is some truth to what the man told me, that laws passed half a century ago primed the conditions that have created today's ugly identity politics. And on the phone with me right now is Mike Gonzalez, who's a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Mike, welcome back.
Hi, Lars. It's so great to be on with you. So your caller used the word plot.
He used a plot. He said, look, this is part of Das Kapital. It's part of communism. It's part of Saul Alinsky. And I said, well, we reference all of those. But I also told him, if I tie all of it together and say it's all part of a master plan, Some of it is, I imagine. And some of the people in the streets are just being pushed around by activists who say, let's go down and protest this or protest that. They come up with some slogans like ACAB, all cops are bastards, and then they're off to the races. And I think some of the people who show up may not be politically inclined at all. They just like going down and smashing things and burning things and feeling as though they have some kind of outlet for their frustration, whatever their frustration is. Is there truth to both sides of that?
No, absolutely. I was interested that he used the word plot because, as you well know, that's in the title of my book, The Plot to Change America.
Yep.
I do believe, and by the way, what you just said just now before, it's absolutely true. There are some people who want to march because they were outraged by the manner in which George Floyd was killed. And, you know, I have members of my family who feel outraged by this. But that is not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is this attempt to change America, to transform America. And the hard left has been very open about this for a very long time. And you're right. I have a piece today in the Wall Street Journal in which I said, I say to our leaders, not just our political leaders, but our corporate leaders and our media leaders, that the last time we had large-scale race riots in the United States in the 1960s and 70s, ideologues and activists intimidated bureaucrats into passing really bad rules, and we're still living with the consequences of that. I believe that identity politics, the foundations of it, were created back then. And I say that in my book, The Plot to Change America. I explained it in my book. I explained it in a short version today in the Wall Street Journal. So absolutely, yes. Yeah, we can talk about that because that is, I think, what is happening.
I mean, because when people talk about transforming something, my wife and I usually buy old houses and we try to transform them into a nice house that doesn't look old and decrepit anymore. We managed to do that. On the other hand, there are things like Hurricane Katrina that transformed New Orleans, but not in a good way. So when people talk about transformation, I guess it depends on what kind of transformation you're talking about, destructive transformation or constructive transformation. Talk about the specific laws in the 1960s, and are we talking mostly about the Great Society?
Yeah, well, there is the Great Society. A lot of these laws were well-intended, but actually it replaced the breadwinner in the house, and we had, as a result, the breakup of the family, and we have a very high national out of wedlock rate right now, and a lot of families have single parents. But the policy that I talked about was actually the creation of racial categories, of ethnic categories, not in races that are based in biology or anything that is real, but ethnic categories that were created by OMB and other government bureaus, cobbled out of very many different people, and two of those in mind, obviously, are Hispanics and Asians, created by Rule Number 15 in 1977 by the Office of Management and Budget. And then you had the creation as well of the racial preferences of identity politics, sorry, of affirmative action. And in these racial preferences of affirmative action, it kind of incentivized people to adhere to these groups, right? But that also creates a third part of the equation, which is a grievance-fueled culture of victimhood. And because you have to say, I am a member of Group B. Group B has been a victim of awful discrimination. I am owed compensatory justice.
Yep.
That is the bricks and mortars of identity politics today. And when that happens, just let me finish out on this. When you create a culture of victimhood, when people draw their pride and their claim on justice on their victimhood, they have zero incentive not to no longer become a victim, to surmount their obstacles and their problems. Victimhood gets put on a hamster wheel that never stops.
Well, and in fact, there used to be a pride. I mean, I remember when I was in high school, somebody say, oh, so-and-so was on welfare. And we said, oh, that's too bad. I hope he gets off of it very quickly, you know, because nobody wanted to be on it. Today, if you said, well, I benefit from set-asides, racial set-asides, gender set-asides, there are contracts set aside for my company that are based on my skin color, based on my gender, these days based on your sexuality. And that all of that says, as long as I'm a victim, I get those things. The minute I say, I'm not a victim, I can compete with everybody else, which I think everybody is perfectly capable of in this society, then all of a sudden you don't get those things anymore, and the politicians lose out because they want you to be captive to that victimhood, because then they can say, if you want the good stuff to continue coming because of your victimhood, you need to vote for me and not that guy.
Yeah, you know, I absolutely right about that. There's two writers out there, two social science writers, Manning and Campbell, who have written about this, and they say exactly what you just said. They call the present age a culture of victimhood, and they say prior to that, your claim to attention, your claim to saying who you were, your claim to pride, was having overcome the challenges that life will always and inevitably throw our way. Life can be a struggle for all of us. Overcoming that struggle is what gets you to the promised land, and then you can say to people, I overcame that challenge. I overcame that struggle, and that is why I am standing here tall. That is less and less the case because, as you say, we reward feelings of grievances.
I think you're right, Mike. And wouldn't it be nice? I mean, I've never heard somebody say, well, I proved to the college I wanted to go to that I was a victim, and so they just gave me free tuition. I have heard people to brag about the lousy jobs they worked to make sure they could pay that next tuition bill. You should read the piece by Mike Gonzalez in the Wall Street Journal and his new book called The Plot to Change America. Mike is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and he's always welcome on this program. Mike, thank you very much. We'll be back in just a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. We'll get back to your phone calls and your emails a bit later. You can always vote in our Twitter poll, at Lars Larson Show. And if you're not a fan of Twitter, and I'm not a particular fan of Twitter, you can vote on our website at LarsLarson.com. It is a real pleasure to welcome to the program Denver Lee Riggleman III, a member of the United States House of Representatives from Virginia's 5th Congressional District. And now, amazingly enough, it's a clever title for a book, Bigfoot, It's Complicated. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Lars, it's always good to be with you, my friend.
So before we get in, I know we're going to get into contemporary politics and what's going on in the world right now. In fact, you and I have to talk about Tony Bobulinski and the interview, at least as you and I are speaking, that happened just last night. But this book really is about this subject. It's about true believers. And there are, I suppose, true believers on both sides of just about every one of those things out there, including Bigfoot that people talk about. Why don't you set the scene for why you decided to write this book?
Well, Tony, I mean, that's what we're talking about, Tony. Well, Lars, the reason I actually started this book 14 years ago, and I was an intelligence officer at the National Security Agency, and I pranked my wife. Took her on a Bigfoot expedition instead of Hawaii for our 15th anniversary. And by the way, I thought it was funny. She did not. So, not at all. And we just had our 31st anniversary yesterday, so I made it. But I started this because I did a lot of work in the Balkans. And I was there during Operation Allied Force, and I saw sort of how belief systems could actually cause some very bad things to happen. As you know, in the former Yugoslavia, you have the Serbs, the Croats, and the Bosniaks, and how they interact, how they killed each other over, you know, millennia. And so what I started to do is when I pranked my wife, I noticed on this Bigfoot expedition that people had different belief systems, and some of them were very strident about it. And I said, what if I actually applied intelligence analysis techniques to what true believers do? Now, by the way, this is an adult travel book. This is not for kids. And the reason I'm releasing this book, too, is this is the very book that I was accused of being Bigfoot erotica by my Democratic opponent.
Yeah.
So that's pretty interesting, is that it's come full circle, that the disinformation that I used to do in information operations got used against me in the political sphere, and now I have a book that is the book that people talked about that really has nothing to do with Bigfoot erotica, even though there's some bizarre belief systems from Bigfoot believers that come close. And it's interesting to me that my Democratic opponent introduced this awfulness through disinformation, and that's why I'm releasing this book today, because we also have QAnon, we have the far left doing things, and it just seems so appropriate today.
Well, and in fact, you're right, because the ability to affect what people can be exposed to in the way of information, whether it's anti-vax information, whether it's Russian disinformation, most recently the Iranians who were identified as being behind the emails that were coming to people, purportedly from conservative groups, but I think in actuality from the mad mullahs of Tehran, trying to say to people, you must do this, and if you do not do the following, change your vote to Donald Trump. And of course, it was the reverse they were looking for. They were looking to paint American voters who received these text messages or emails as victims of disinformation coming from American conservative groups, and it was actually coming from the crazies on the other side of the world in Iran.
Absolutely. And people say, you know, they get all surprised that, you know, oh my gosh, how is this happening? You know, Russia or Iran or China, you know, how are they able to inject disinformation? You know, this is so new. And on social media, it is. Social media has really sort of exacerbated the radicalization problem with the disinformation problem. But, you know, I tell people, you know, I have a university education. I got to go overseas and do crazy things. The Communist International in 1919 started this, you know, just sort of this amazing thrust in disinformation by publicly supporting administrations or regimes and then undermining them, right, through revolution. This is not something that's surprising. And I find it surprising. I scratch my head a little bit, Lars, because I look at people and say, listen, it's just a... They're using the same methodology. They just have a much more advanced vehicle.
And today, so amazing about it. Well, in fact, the United States Congress this week is talking to Twitter and Facebook and Google and saying, what the, and as Ted Cruz just said earlier today, what the heck, who appointed you as the arbiter of what Americans get to hear or not hear when it comes to information that might be relevant to an election? And of course, Jack Dorsey says, well, you know, I'm not doing any of that. And he actually flatly denies that the guy who heads up Twitter denies that he has any power to affect the outcome of elections. You've been in the business of doing this on behalf of the U.S. military. And you know, well, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Is it possible for these big social media giants to affect the outcome of an election?
Yeah, and that's, you know, of course it is. And listen, information is probably our most valuable commodity. And underneath that, you know, in order to have information, you have to have lots of data, right? And how do I say it in a way that's not completely intelligence analysis geekdom, Lars? But so you have a lot of data. The more data you have, and if you can actually merge and aggregate that data, and then you can target that data algorithmically where you need it to go. It not only exacerbates echo chambers, whether on the right or the left, but you can also manipulate the actual dialogue. And, you know, and I'm telling people, like, this is not, again, this has been done dropping leaflets, the press, newspapers, you know, inserting certain things in political individuals' mouths to push a certain agenda. People are like, oh, this blows my mind. Well, it shouldn't. The manipulation of information through massive access to data is something that's been tried and attempted for a long time. If you have these large companies that have access to data that we don't have, say, if they can aggregate massive amounts of data and wrap algorithms around that to target that data to certain people, it exacerbates the echo chamber. And that's the thing, that this is not something that's new. It's just that the media they have or the technology they have makes it so much more powerful.
I'm talking to Congressman Denver Riggleman, who's the author most recently of Bigfoot, It's Complicated, which is not really about, well, it's as much about Bigfoot as it is about any of the other true believer subjects out there. And I guess, Congressman, I'd have to plead guilty. There are things I truly believe in. I believe that Joe Biden was involved in his son's financial shenanigans, and I believe he benefited financially, and I believe he participated, just probably as firmly as a lot of Democrats believe that Donald Trump is a Russian mole in the White House, except that in the case of Trump, we got an FBI investigation, we got a special counsel investigation, we got a congressional investigation, and they all came up completely empty. And said, no, it's not the case. But when we get a society that then says, but if there's an accusation, a credible one, against an American presidential candidate like Joe Biden, and the election is right around the corner next week, we need to ignore that one studiously. How do we fix that?
Well, I talked to somebody about that, you know, because I was incredibly critical of the hiring practice of the president. Obviously, I voted against impeachment because there were a lot of grifters around the president, right? But there wasn't an impeachable offense there. And the grifting happens around Joe Biden, too. And I had somebody tell me, they said, hey, Denver, you know, I don't think it's a big deal. And I said, well, why not? They said, well, all politicians are slimy. Don't they all use their name this way? I mean, right? And I'm like, oh my goodness, right? Is this where we're at? If somebody finds it impossible that Vice President Biden wasn't involved using the family name to sort of enhance connections with foreign business interests, obviously that's true. That's not a, again, this isn't mind blowing stuff. This is what, man, I just sound like Ricky Gervais, my voice. this isn't mind blowing stuff, you know. This isn't something that's like, people say, oh my God, you know, Jiminy Christmas, you're telling me that Joe Biden was leveraging his name. The issue that they have is that the company they were dealing with accused of money laundering. This is where I start looking at people like, what is the real issue here? The real issue, were they dealing with a company involved in illegal activities? That's the issue, right, Lars?
When we come back, well, I'm talking to Congressman Denver Ringelmann from Manassas, Virginia. He's the author of Bigfoot, It's Complicated, and we'll be right back on the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you, and always glad to take your calls. We'll do that a bit later. I'm talking to Congressman Denver Ringelmann from Manassas, Virginia, who represents Virginia's 5th Congressional District. And we're talking a little bit about government, but a lot about his book. He's written a book called Bigfoot, It's Complicated, this fall, in the middle of a China virus pandemic, so people have lots of time to read. But let's talk. I want to go back to Hunter Biden for a moment, because you said, okay, it's a problem because the company that Joe Biden may have been involved in through his son Hunter's shenanigans, which I say shenanigans, his crimes, I think, but is because it's involved in money laundering. But let me put something to you. If I were a county commissioner there in Manassas, And I had a son-in-law who worked for a local paving company. If my job as a county commissioner is to find the best deal for the taxpayers, for the citizens in paving roads, but they notice that I keep sending all the county paving contracts over to my son-in-law's business because he's married to my daughter, you might properly say, are you making the best decision for the citizens, or are you making a decision because it's best for your family? And I think that's the problem I have with the Hunter Biden stuff. When he's saying, hey, I can set up a meeting with my dad for executives of companies like Burisma or this Chinese energy company, you might say, well, that's relatively harmless. Unless, of course, the Vice President of the United States at the time is making decisions where he's not just saying this is the best decision for the public, but it's for the voters of America, it's the best decision for my family. And when you complicate those two, how do we ever decide whether Joe Biden needed to threaten that Ukrainian prosecutor, threaten the government to get them to fire the prosecutor? Was it because it was the best thing for the United States' interests, or was it the best thing for Hunter Biden's interests? And I think once you have the appearance of impropriety and the appearance of influence, there's no way to say for sure whether Joe Biden would have made the same decision if his son Hunter was not working at Burisma, is there?
No, and by the way, I think you just sort of nailed the issue that people have that get into public service. For instance, I sort of came from the outside, Lars, so I don't need the paycheck, right? I've done things independently where I don't need a paycheck at all if I serve. I mean, it's just that simple. But when you see 47 years of Biden being in public service, that's why I think some people were sort of, you know, I would say sanitized, right, to the fact, oh, of course, all of them are slimy. The issue, and you're right, the issue is, obviously, there's an appearance of impropriety, right, Lars? I mean, and listening to Tony Bobulinski last night, you know, when he said, me and you talked about this, when he got over his skis, when he said that, I told you guys you're way over your skis, what he was trying to tell them is that, like, there's a fine line between leaning forward and bending over, right?
Right.
And the issue that you have right now is you're going into illegal activities, or you're going into a place that has such a bad appearance, you guys should pull back on the throttle, right? That's enough. And I think looking at his mannerisms, this was a guy who said in the interview he did not want to come forward, Lars. That's what you talk about, honest. He's like, I didn't want to put my there was no way I'm coming to this until they accused me of Russian disinformation.
Right.
Because at that point, being a person who's, you know, and so that is why when you're saying those things, for people like me who was not in politics, I automatically recoil when I hear about what the Biden family is doing. And I recoil because it seems like political service is being used as a career path to enrich others rather than helping those that you've taken an oath to serve. And I think that's what's so diabolical about it.
That's what I see it as. Because I got to tell you, Congressman, you're in Congress. There's a rule called payola. And I am not allowed to take money in exchange for putting something on the air. And they say, well, Lars, you do commercials. And I say, yes, the FCC says you can do commercials, but it has to be through the front door with everybody on notice as to how much the commercials cost, who they were sold to, and everything else. But if, you know, I've had people say, I sit in a restaurant, and they'll say, well, I haven't done that in a while, but because of the, you know, the China virus, but they say, right. How can I get you to mention my restaurant? And I'll say, make me pay full rate. And they said, what do you mean? I said, if you give me a deal, I can't mention you at all. But if you make me, like any other customer, pay full rate, I cannot take anything of value. And they actually send people in my business to prison for doing that. And but if somehow I wanted to camouflage a payment, and I've been very careful to avoid this my entire career, I could say, well, you can't pay me, but you know, my father-in-law, who actually lives on the same 2 acres we live on, my father-in-law, you could do some favors for him. And that's the sort of back door that I see Hunter Biden as having used. And I think Joe Biden has received substantial amounts of money because of this illicit dealing. I'm a true believer
amazing,
on that, Congressman.
Lars. You are an amazing Lars. I think what you talked about is the power of the ability to grift on levels that's unimaginable when you're in politics. And, you know, and that grift can be used, you know, where, you know, well, it's sort of legal. I mean, it's so unethical and so slimy. But they still try that grift sort of in the left-right boundary of what they believe is legal, regardless of what it is. And I think that's what I was so, I guess, watching that whole thing last night. I'm like, you know, listen, this people need to listen to what's going on here. And whether people want to cover it or not, I think when you have an individual like, you know, Bobulinski come out and say, listen, I don't want to be here, but the grift was so bad that and they accused me of so many awful things on Russian disinformation, I had to come out. I mean, this guy didn't want to go on Tucker Carlson. Come on, Lars. Do you think,
well,
you know what is going to happen to this poor guy?
Well, and, maybe, but Congressman, I will tell you this. I do a commentary that I write every morning. And I said, look, Tony Bobulinski looks like a great witness. He's wealthy. You know, he's not super wealthy, but he's worth a few million bucks. He's got a history of donating to Democrats. He's a Navy veteran who either holds or held a Q clearance, a top secret clearance. And he got mad when the Democrats said, oh, this is foreign disinformation, as though Tony Bobulinski is some Russian stooge. So if you say all the usual check marks that you would say, this guy is worried about going to prison. No, he doesn't appear to have done anything illegal. He wants to sell a book. No, he's not selling a book. He's running for office. No, he's not running for office. He wants to make some money. No, he's already wealthy. And he doesn't want to be sitting in a on a camera with Tucker Carlson. He's got great credentials, right?
That's right. Great credentials. Yeah. And, you know, and Tucker let him talk. I mean, if you look at the interview, Tucker's like, what is going on? And Bobulinski's like, this is it. Boom, boom, boom. And again, I got to tell you, I was impressed. I mean, he laid it out in a military fashion, chronologically, not just anecdotally. He has the proof. And I think that's the thing that really, I think, caught people's attention is that he was very clear. I don't know, Lars, if you thought that or not, but I thought
he did.
Very clear and transparent about the way he broke that down. And again, it's the grift. And I think that's what, you know, what happened here with the Republican Party of Virginia, where they denounced what happened to me here based on pay to play and based on people trying to hide money and, you know, what happened to me. And I think that's part of all of this, right? It's sort of wrapped into this big wrapper of a grift. And I think that's what people are going to be surprised about what I wrote. They're going to see me on the cover with a Bigfoot, you know, with their hand on their shoulder while I'm looking concerned.
Congressman, what is this about? And what do you, is this really an indictment of true believers, or is it a support book for true believers to say, look, there's nothing wrong with being a true believer, but please let's look at the information first.
Yeah, I mean, and in this one, it was about weaponizing myth or about people who did not like each other just based on their different belief systems on something completely mythological like Bigfoot, right? And, you know, and like I said, it goes back to what happened to me, the disinformation about Bigfoot erotica, and this is the exact book, so people might be disappointed if, you know, if you're into Bigfoot erotica, probably not your book. But if you're into bizarre beliefs and some things that are very adult about what they believe, this is it. This isn't for children. Because it should make you laugh, it should make you cry, but it also is going to terrify you. Because what you see is that belief systems can morph very quickly and cause anger and cause really a sort of bitterness and some happiness. So I never really mock the true believer on this, on some of these, because some believe maybe there's four different Bigfoot belief systems. All of them don't like each other in some respects. You know, and if I went into that, you know, it's a long time. But they actually are different. They're sects of Bigfoot believers.
My guest is Denver Riggleman, member of Congress, represents the 5th District in the great Commonwealth, not a state, a Commonwealth of Virginia. Bigfoot, it's complicated. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. My guest is Denver Riggleman from the great Commonwealth of Virginia. He's a member of Congress representing Virginia in the 5th Congressional District. His book is called Bigfoot, It's Complicated. Now, we talked a lot about politics and what's going on right now. Congressman, I don't call myself a QAnon, and I warn people that one of the techniques, there's a particular guy in my business in talk radio, and I tell people, they say, well, it sounds so real. I said, well, if I wanted to do this, I said, I don't do this. I always tell my audience, I'm going to tell you what I honestly believe, and if you ask me why, I'll send you the whatever source material I can, and I usually cite it on the air, so I'll say I'm getting it from this study or that person or this interview. But if you really want to snow people, tell them 48 true things, and then mix into the 48 true things one or two things that are completely fabricated, but they're what you want to get across. And if you wrap those two things that are not true, that might be hard to believe, into all that other information that people know for a fact is true, you can make them believe things that aren't true by simply wrapping them in enough things that they know are true. I guess that's the way I always visualize it. And I know people in my business who do exactly that. They're wanting to sell a particular piece of information, and they realize if you held it up by itself, it falls apart like a cheap, you know, suitcase. But if you wrap it up with a bunch of other stuff people know to be true and just rattle them all off at the same time, you get people saying, yeah, sounds like that's pretty plausible, because they recognize the whole looks plausible because all these true things and the one or two little things in there that you're trying to grift somebody on, those are the false ones. But they can't spot them because you've wrapped them up in all these other true things.
And you know, there's a chapter in my book called Jim Jones Had Charisma, right? And so what I try to get across...
He was also allied with the Democrat Party in San Francisco, unfortunately.
Right? And so what's funny about this is I asked somebody, and Lars, you'll probably say, hey, do you believe that... Are you anti-racist completely? Well, yeah, Denver, absolutely. Do you believe in love for all and that we can all take care of each other? He goes, oh, my God, yes, I absolutely believe that. He goes, Denver, it's really nice that you would believe that. I said, do you believe we can all live almost... I mean, I'm not saying we should be, you know, live Soviet-style communes, but don't you think that in some way, if we loved all of others, we could sort of live communally, right? And we could share things and just have a lot of fun together. Goes, absolutely. I said, well, you know, that's what Jim Jones preached, right? And it's almost like, you know, we've heard of gateway drugs, we won't argue that, but there's gateway myths or innocuous sort of door. The door for QAnon is save our children. And what I said on one news show, I said, you know who hates pedophilia? Everybody who's not pedophiles, right? So the save our children is the door. And the door, if you go through that and you think that's what you're for, there's some very disturbing underlying tropes in the QAnon movement that are anti-Semitic, they're dehumanizing, right? And sometimes even call for violence. And that's what I try to tell people is that, you know, you have this sort of gateway or opaqueness. Like you said, it's this nugget of sort of darkness wrapped in truth, right? And that's the kind of stuff that I'm warning people about in the intelligence business. It's really easy for me to get over on you. I can. I just don't do it because that is not responsible, and I took an oath to the Constitution, and I'm not going to spread disinformation. But if you allow that save our children or whatever innocuous thing you think it is or you're trying to do this, and then underneath that, you think that Bibi Netanyahu is running a pedophile ring in Israel. I was accused of leading that pedophile ring, right?
Are you kidding?
You have gone. I'm not kidding. No.
I love Netanyahu. If Netanyahu were a natural-born American citizen, I'd vote for him for president in one of the elections. I think that much of the guy.
Well, I know I don't want to curse and stuff, but I've been called an effing Jew. And by the way, I'm not Jewish, which should piss off Jews. I'm getting, you know, they're like, Denver, you're not even Jewish, you know. And I'm getting massive behavior. I've been called a member of the Zog. I've been sent a picture of the gallows that I'm now on the target list. But you know, I sort of ignore it because keyboard warriors don't scare me, right? I mean, I bombed the Taliban, right? If you want to come at me, you're gonna have to do a lot more than sitting in your basement on the beanbag, you know, on Twitter, right? You know, Twitteria, you know, Twitter and diarrhea together. But
yep.
I think what we have here, though, is that you now have you know, somebody like Anna Kate, K-H-A-I-T, who is a Survivor contestant, saying we should hang traitors, and that one of them was Joe Biden because he ordered the killing of SEAL Team 6, or that Osama bin Laden had a double when we killed him, or that we somehow owed Iran, you know, billions of dollars, and that's why they killed SEAL Team 6, and we gave that as tribute, you know, something like that. You know, and people are like, well, this would save our children, but you know what? That sounds like that could happen, right? And when you have people with millions yep. of subscribers or tens of thousands of Twitter followers, you're deliberately spreading disinformation that is very harmful and dehumanizes others, and violence could happen. That's why the FBI is worried about it, and that's why intelligence analysts are worried about it, because they're like, what is happening here? We have hundreds of thousands of individual users on Facebook. Telegram is exploding. Twitter's exploding, but the Chans and the Coons are exploding with these type of conspiracy theories and ridiculousness. The biggest danger, Lars, is that QAnon is federated. And, you know, you have federated databases where you have multiple data streams coming into one database. You have multiple conspiracy yeah. theories coming into one actual wrapper, and that's the QAnon wrapper. And the fact is, we cannot be disseminating false information. I think that's why the Republicans were mad at me and the Democrats. When I go after, you know, I'm also on the board of the Network Contagion Research Institute, and when I see coded language coming out of the far left to organize violence, I call it out. When I see the president retweeting something dangerous, like the SEAL Team 6 theory, which comes from Q bases, or from a Q basis, I call it out. And I think that is our responsibility, regardless of our party affiliation, regardless of where we stand on the political spectrum or religious spectrum. When we see crazy, we got to call it out. Because the last thing we want to see, buddy, is people running this country, right, who believe Lord of the Rings is a document.
Congressman, congratulations on Bigfoot. It's complicated. When we get out of this China virus nonsense, I'll look forward to visiting Virginia again, and I really appreciate your time.
Much respect, Lars. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you very much. That's Denver Riggleman, member of Congress from the 5th Congressional District in the great Commonwealth of Virginia. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Always glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. And I'm sick and tired of the riots and the violence that have gone on for the better part of the last 5 months. We're now heading toward the 6th month of this nonsense. And I always thought that much of this was based around the idea that we had an election coming up, and that some of the political elites who made the decisions to tie the hands of police and say, you can't do anything about this, just let them burn, let them loot, let them assault. And then when the election was over, a lot of it would go away. Now, so far, I know the election's only a couple of days in the past, so far it has not gone away. And the demands for defunding the police or somehow reining in law enforcement, eliminating prisons, eliminating the rule of law, that hasn't happened yet, and let's hope that it doesn't. But are those protests and riots that we've seen from month after month and the literally billions of dollars of damage that they've done in America, are they going to actually accomplish anything? I thought I'd talk to Katie Gorka, who's the director of the Fulner Institute Center for Civil Society and the American Dialogue at Heritage. Join me. Katie, thank you so much for coming on. And in case people recognize your last name, yes, Sebastian is her lesser half. Katie, how are you?
I'm great, Lars. How are you?
I'm doing very well, and give my best to Sebastian. I haven't seen him in person in a long time, but we chat by email every once in a while and text and all that. But really, the question comes down to, are all these protests and riots going to accomplish anything at all? And are they truly going to put America on a path towards seeing our police department simply eliminated and the rule of law, you know, pushed into the rearview mirror?
Well, you know, I think that we really value protests in this country, right? Let's be honest about it. Protests
Agreed.
Are part of the sacred American tradition, but there's a way to do it and there's a way not to do it. And I think what we've seen in the last 5 months is the way not to do it. And I've argued that the protesters have really undermined their cause with the way they've gone about this. And, you know, it's really starting to remind me of the French Revolution, when the revolution is going to start eating its own, and you already see that happening.
I've seen some of it happening, too. In fact, in the community I live in, last night, some of these rioters showed up at the home of a city official who had just voted no to the idea of defunding another tens of millions of dollars from the police department. And now you're seeing groups like that are allied with Black Lives Matter saying, putting out press releases saying, hey, that's not us. Well, as far as I'm concerned, BLM and Antifa and the rioters all allied with each other, and they all got something from that, you know, I think that very fraught kind of relationship that they had, and they knew it. They knew, and in fact, I saw people allied with BLM saying, well, we get more attention to the cause if we break something or burn something. And they would actually say it out loud. Having done that, it's awfully tough to then say, oh, hold on, the people breaking and burning stuff, that's not us. We still have a legitimate cause. Because I think an awful lot of Americans are sick to death of it like I am.
Yeah, I know. I cannot believe the stories coming out of Portland. The fact that this poor city commissioner, if my understanding is they've been there four nights in a row now. And breaking windows and causing damage, I guess, last night was sort of the height of it. But it's pretty amazing and pretty scary. But, you know, when we look back at our history, even just the last half century, what we saw was the civil rights movement of the 60s was actually, you know, the peaceful protests, I would argue, were really effective in elevating the issue of racial inequality, both as a news item, but I think more importantly in people's hearts. I think it really helped a lot of Americans to see the pain that Black people were suffering in this country. You know, unfortunately, then as now, when those protests turn violent, people turn against the protests. And that's what's happening today as well. I think that, you know, that we had a moment, and it was, unfortunately, I think it was very short-lived. You know, early on where really an extraordinary number of Americans took to the streets to protest the death of George Floyd. But as soon as it turned violent, I think that people started turning against it. And I think today, you know, I think they've really, really undermined their cause. And, you know, it doesn't help either the fact that what they're calling for is not to tweak our system, not to improve our good system, but to actually rip it down altogether and replace it with socialism.
You know, the other thing that bothers me, and Katie, I think there's a really ugly irony in what BLM is pushing now. If you went back to Mark Twain's time, in fact, he wrote some famous essays. I used to read one of them on the air, but he uses a word, as an abolitionist, he used a word that nobody can use in polite company anymore. And what would happen is a mob would be angry about something that had happened, say a crime, usually a crime of murder, a crime of some, like rape. And they would say, give that guy and let's put a rope around his neck and let's kill him. And we'll call that justice. And oftentimes it was the wrong guy. It wasn't the person who'd done the crime at all. But they called it justice because a mob in the streets, usually a tiny group of people from the entire community, would say, we're the loudest mob. Give that person over to us. We're going to kill him. And we said, well, that's horrible. That's awful that once happened in America. Well, today, what do you have? You have relatively small groups. I mean, they're scary in size, you know, by themselves, 5,000, 10,000 people who showed up in these big cities. And they start screaming and yelling in cities of hundreds of thousands of people who don't necessarily share their point of view. And they've said, because we're a loud mob in the streets, we demand that you do things our way. To me, and their way is demonstrably dangerous to the rest of the community. Get rid of all the cops, stop enforcing laws, let everybody out of prison, which is what they've asked for. And their cries that all cops are bastards and that cops should die and spitting in the face of cops or actually physically hurting cops and in a few cases murdering people, this is what the mob has done. And apparently they don't see the irony that that same kind of mob justice was no more right back in Twain's time than it is today.
Well, I think what's interesting is a story that we heard in Washington this morning. I don't know if this has gone national yet or not, but there's a woman who was defending her seat down in Southern Virginia named Abigail Spanberger. She narrowly held on to her seat. She's a Democrat. She narrowly held on to it, but apparently she railed against some of her colleagues in private and said, you all have got to stop talking about defunding the police because that nearly cost me my election. So I think it's really interesting that the Democrats themselves are waking up to the fact that this isn't flying with the American voter. People don't like this. It makes them panic, and rightly so.
Well, and as you say, this is when the movement starts to eat its own. But isn't it interesting that she objected to defunding the police not because it was bad for the community not to have people you can call on at 2 in the morning when you hear glass breaking somewhere in your house, but because it wrecked, nearly cost her seat. And that was her big concern. Not the fact that it might actually put lives at risk in the community. No, I almost lost my place in government. Now, that seems like a bad idea to object to something.
Yeah, no, there you go. I think there's also a really interesting point that's been made by Shelby Steele. He's got a new film out called What Killed Michael Brown, where he goes back and looks at that particular incident. And the point that he makes is it's really a mistake to portray all these incidents as similar.
Katie Gorka, who is with the Fulner Institute for Civil Society at Heritage. Katie, thanks so much. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails. We'll do more of that a bit later, but if you want to join in, naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. I know that Joe Biden has been doing his best to try to persuade people that he's not going to take your guns away, even though he has said just that. And in fact, you might not remember this. No reporters are out there who are actually going to ask him, weren't you going to put the great Beto O'Rourke from Texas in charge of gun control? Wasn't that what you said about a year ago? Well, Joe Biden is now pushing for a ban on assault rifles after a coward tried to assassinate two cops in Los Angeles, in Compton. But the assassin was using a handgun. And I'm not quite sure how the two tie together, why Joe Biden sees a connection there. But then again, as I played the audio for you earlier, Joe Biden actually said that American troops have been lost on the ground in Iran. And last time I checked, we didn't have any troops on the ground in Iran. Not yet, and maybe not ever. Amy Swearer is a legal fellow and a senior legal policy analyst at the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Amy, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Can we get the straight skinny on what it is Joe Biden actually stands for? Because I know we're used to seeing him flip-flop on all kinds of things, from fracking to everything else. And he's flip-flopped on the Iraq War. He's flip-flopped on Osama bin Laden and going after him. And now, can we get a straight picture of what this candidate of the Democrat Party believes when it comes to sporting rifles, which a lot of us own? I have to admit, I have a dog in the fight, or I have a gun in the bunch, because Joe Biden wants to ban some of the rifles that I own.
That's right. You know, and you're not alone in having a dog in the fight. There are millions of Americans who have these so-called assault weapons, which are really just semi-automatic firearms, semi-automatic rifles with factory standard magazines, again, owned by millions of Americans. So when it comes to what Joe Biden actually stands for, you're right in suggesting he sort of tries to ride the line here a little bit. So on the one hand, he'll go around saying, I don't want to take your guns. And then on the other hand, he will go around saying, I'm going to put Beto, hell yes, I'm going to take your AR-15 in charge of, as the gun czar, if you will. When you look at his actual policy proposal, it looks like what he would do is sort of reinstate the 1994 assault weapons ban, which expired in the early 2000s, ban them from being sold to new individuals, and then basically turn existing weapons into NFA weapons, kind of like fully automatic firearms, where you'd have to pay several hundreds of dollars in taxes, get it approved by the NFA or by the ATF, and sort of go through this very intensive licensing project and never be able to really use them. And then when you die, you can't transfer them to anyone else. And that's when the government is going to take your guns. So it's no, not confiscation, but it's eventually going to confiscate them.
Well, and eventually, I mean, it takes all of us who own those rifles and says you can own it, but you're going to have to jump through all these hoops. It's going to cost you a lot of money. And they know that a lot of Americans are going to say, well, I'm not going to go through all that hassle. And then they will try to sell them. The problem is you can only sell them to somebody who's willing to go through all that extra razzmatazz from the federal government. And none of that has anything to do with stopping crime, does it?
No, absolutely not. So what we know about these weapons is that they're actually very rarely used for criminal purposes. So when you look at homicides, for example, rifles of any kind, that's not just semi-automatic rifles, but bolt-action rifles, you know, any sort of rifle, are only used for about 3% of homicides. And it's even rarer when it comes to sort of other types of criminal events. Your most common type of firearm for criminal usage is actually handguns, which we know, again, both from the Constitution and from the Supreme Court in District of Columbia v. Heller, are absolutely positively covered by the Second Amendment. So when it comes to crime, it's actually handguns that are the problem, and we know those are protected. So, of course, then the guns that are used very rarely in crime, like semi-automatic rifles, are certainly protected and could not be banned in this way.
The other nuance of this, I'm talking to Amy Swearer from the Heritage Foundation, and I want to point this out because I don't think reporters do it often enough. The quote from the former vice president is, "We need to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines." Yet even Joe Biden isn't going to ban them. He's going to say you can't buy any new ones. But the millions of them that are already out there, including the ones I own, would still be out there. Joe Biden is not literally calling for a ban on the rifles, is he?
Yes and no. So again, he would ban new sales of them. From what I understand, you wouldn't be able to transfer them either. But then you run into this problem. So let's say you have several weapons that fall under this category. You would have to pay the several hundred dollars in taxes to get these registered for each weapon and then each magazine that's over 10 rounds. So if you've got a couple of these, you're looking at several thousands of dollars, or you're going to have to give them up to the government. So it's either you have to pay or you have to give them up. And regardless, because they wouldn't be transferable, if you were to die, you couldn't, you know, give them to someone else. They would eventually, in the long run, be confiscated, kind of like what California and New York are trying to do.
Well, the only reason I'm pointing out that distinction is that if he says we want to get these off the streets, weapons of war have no place in our communities. I think he's wrong about them being weapons of war. Nobody in the military I've ever met went to war with an AR-15, nor would they. They go with a very specialized, fully automatic weapon that they're able to use for the job it's intended for. The semi-automatic weapons are simply semi-automatic weapons. But when he says I'm calling for a ban, we need to ban them, he's not literally talking about taking them out of communities like, say, New York did when they said you can't possess one of these rifles anymore. And they forced a million people to make the choice of somehow giving up those guns because you couldn't sell them and you couldn't trade them. I guess you could drive them to a friend out of state and gift them to them. But he's really not talking about a ban. But he wants it to sound like he's talking about a ban because you could say my automobile costs me hundreds of dollars every year to license and drive on the public roads. It's not a ban on cars, but it does cost a lot of money to be able to own one. I'm not defending the idea of putting those same limitations on firearms. But if somebody said cars are banned in America, and I said, what do you mean? They said, well, it costs hundreds of dollars to own one. Yeah, it does. But it doesn't. It's not a ban on cars. And so when he wants the political benefit of calling for a ban without actually calling for a ban, I think we should call him on it.
Right. And this is actually, it raises a very interesting constitutional question. So the argument for why this ban would be, or that these sorts of regulations would be constitutional, is that these guns are so uber extra dangerous that they simply cannot be in the hands of any law-abiding citizen. Well, if that's the case, then why would you then allow 15 million plus people to continue to own them? So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. He's trying to have it both ways by saying, oh, we can ban future ones because they're so extra dangerous. But you go ahead and keep your extra dangerous weapon that no one should own. So either way, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. He's trying to ride that line, have it both ways. And it just doesn't make anybody happy. And it's neither constitutional nor going to solve any problems.
Amy, thanks for the work you do at Heritage. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you on. That's Amy Swearer, legal fellow and policy analyst at the Mies Center. We'll be back in just a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I have to share something with you. My granddaughter spends a lot of time at our house with COVID and everything else, and I work out of a home studio. So she says to Nana, my wife, Tina, she says, why does Honey Man have to talk all day long? She's 4 and a half. And the simplest explanation we've come up with for her is that's because he's earning Barbie money for Barbie dolls. And she accepts that as necessary. Now, this is why Payson Anderson will never grow up to be an infantilized teen or adult the way we're seeing so many infantilized adults today. And I know another family that is not going to produce infantilized adults is Adam Carolla, because Adam is the guy I copied when we gave that explanation. His kids were a little older, I think, when he said, Dad has to work on a Saturday, and everybody groans in unison. And he says, well, you know, all this stuff around us comes from Dad working. So they said, oh, okay, off to work you go, Dad. Was that about the way it went down, Adam?
Yeah, you know, I talk so much like you, Lars, and I say so much to so many people in my family who mainly don't listen, that I can't even recall all the daddy stories I've tried to impart on these kids.
Well, I know that you shared that with us at one point. Now, I guess I was thinking about infantilized adults as I considered our time with you to talk about No Safe Spaces, the documentary You Have the Right to Remain Silent, a production of both Adam Carolla, who I'm talking to now, and our friend Dennis Prager. I want you to go back to why you decided this was a worthy project for Adam Carolla's many talents, given that you've got about 90 irons in the fire every time I talk to you.
You know, honestly, the project wasn't something that attracted me as much as hanging out with Dennis Prager and working with Dennis Prager was attractive to me. The project was almost a secondary decision versus hanging out with and working with Dennis Prager. It truly was.
Well, Dennis Prager is an impressive guy. Let me ask you about No Safe Spaces, the whole idea that the phrase, I don't know exactly when it dates to, but it's not long ago that we came up with this, or we started hearing about this idea. I didn't come up with it because I think it's ridiculous that adults, even college-age adults, smart adults, at least in theory, have decided that some ideas and some speech is so disturbing to them that having heard it, they become triggered and they need a safe space to retreat to. And this film is essentially a refutation of that idea, is it not?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I mean, ultimately, we used to live in a physical, tangible world. So if you know, people worked at sawmills and, you know, if you had big biceps, you were probably in charge. And now we're living in a digital world where whoever controls the information is in charge. And if you want to control the information, you control the language. And you want to control the language, you control the ideas. And next thing you know, you're in charge. You have the power. That's a kind of a scary digital reality. And I don't really want to live in that world. So this is sort of the beginning of control. It's all about power and control. It's not, if you really think about it, why don't they want you to say this? Or why don't they want to give you the ability to say that? Because they're neutral on the notion of power and control. It all plays into the theme of power and control. Once they deplatform you or can tell you what to say, then they have, they can govern you. They essentially have dominion over you, which is what they want. They want a sort of invisible dominion versus a tangible dominion, which is, I'll beat you up if you say something I disagree with. They can't do that, but they can do one better. They can get you fired.
And in fact, No Safe Space is the movie produced by Adam Carolla and Dennis Prager and a lot of other talented individuals, including Justin Folk. One of the stories you talk about is one that's from my neck of the woods, Brett Weinstein, a biology professor at a college in Washington State called Evergreen State College, a state institution. And there had been a longstanding tradition of a day of absence. So all of the people of color who were either students or faculty on the campus would simply stay away from a day, for a day. And they would say, effectively, see how much you miss us when we're not there. And then one time they said, no, we demand that all of the white people, both students and professors, leave the campus. And one of the professors, Brett Weinstein, had the guts to stand up and say, no, not going to do it. This is foolish. And in the end, he ended up resigning. I think he brought a lawsuit, but No Safe Spaces tells his story. And that's exactly what you were speaking about. The idea, we will control you. And if we tell you to leave because of your skin color, it's not a racist idea, as when people were told to leave a place because of their skin color in the 50s and 60s. We clearly see that as a racist action. But today, it's defended as legitimate to demand people behave differently because of their skin color?
Well, yes. And if you think about it, think about the notion of what they were doing, because you see it all the time. It's from the progressive movement. So think about the progressive movement. It's got the word progress and movement in it. It's never going to stop. By nature, it's called progressive movement. So think about what they did. They go, hey, we're going to have this day, and it'll be a day without a black person, and all people of color stay home. And the faculty and the administration at Evergreen go, okay, we respect that. Go ahead. And they do it. And they do it for a number of years. But at a certain point, they realize they're not upsetting anybody. There's nobody pushing back against them. Nobody seems to care whether they're there or not. So they go, you know what? We're part of a progressive movement. We got to keep going forward. So we're bored with this thing that something we declared a few years ago that we thought was radical is now passe. So what do? Because we're not upsetting people. That's the thing. The worst thing you can say to these people when they say, here's what I'm going to do, is you go, yeah, go ahead, knock yourself out. I'll be over here working. They hate that. It's not enough for them. So now they have to realize, because their goal isn't equality. Their goal is upsetting and screwing with the standards and the norms and whatever's around them, because there's no place that's more progressive than Evergreen. You guys got to look into that school. It's a utopia. You know, it's a progressive paradise. So what do? Then they start demanding. Then when a guy like Brett Weinstein says, no, not going to go along with that, then they declare fatwa on the guy and chase him around the campus. And the administration does nothing.
I'm talking to Adam Carolla. He's produced No Safe Spaces with Dennis Prager. Believe me, Adam, we keep an eye on that college on a regular basis. I have to say I feel a little guilty about it, because Evergreen State College, paid for by the taxpayers, actually generates more than its fair share of great talk show topics, because you only have to wake up, take a look at the news, and see that they've done something else that's crazy. And of course, when you tell people this crazy is being paid for with your tax dollars, they're less than happy about it.
Yeah, it's now sort of jumped the shark and become almost surreal, some of the stuff they're wanting. But really what they want is a reaction from you. So if everyone says, yeah, all right, stay home, that's not nearly enough. And by the way, if Brett Weinstein and all the rest of the faculty had just gone home like they'd commanded them to do, in 4 years, they'd demand that they come back to campus, remove their shirts, and flog themselves with a cat of nine tails as they walked in a circle in front of the cafeteria.
The movie is called No Safe Spaces. Its producers are Adam Carolla and Dennis Prager. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'm talking to Adam Carolla, who along with Dennis Prager produced No Safe Spaces. You have the right to remain silent. And it's a great idea to take this on. You and I talked about control. You said, and I agree with you, this is about control. So here's the part I don't understand. If we all collectively agree that more than 150 years ago, it was wrong to control people, to say to them, because of the color of your skin, we will say that you are subject to ownership, you are a slave, we'll decide what you do, and we will dispose of you as readily or as easily as somebody might dispose of a piece of farm equipment today that's not doing its job. That was evil. It was wrong. And America's founders envisioned the day when all people would be treated equally, regardless of skin color, religion, race, and everything else. So how is it that this movement can foist itself on a country having agreed that it's wrong to control people that way, and now say, now our goal is to control you, and we're going to base it on largely the same thing that slavery was based on, the color of your skin, and regarding you as less than worthy? How does that work?
You know, you have to have a lot of people that graduated college in order for this to work. And you have to have a lot of people who work in a kind of digital, invisible world in order for these horrible ideas to find a home. So, Lars, my take on this, because I do work in the digital world, but I also do a lot of work in the mechanical, tangible world. These ideas are rejected wholesale by all the guys I know who work around metal, who fabricate, who build cars, who hang drywall. Those guys don't buy into any of this stuff because they have to live in a real, tangible world, a world of engineering and mechanics where things have to work. They can't just be ideas. They actually have to be applied. So as a society, the more people you move out of those kinds of jobs, building jobs and lumber mill jobs and factory jobs, the more people you move out of that who get college degrees and then move into a digital world, the more citizens you're going to have with weak minds who are able, where this seed could find a purchase, these horrible seeds of ideas can find homes. Think about it. They're not, this doesn't work with guys who go to work and, you know, frame condos all day or in the shipbuilding industry. Engineers, you know, here's what you can do, Lars. You go to Las Vegas, find one of the many huge casinos that's under construction, find the guys that are hanging the I-beams and setting them in place, and go quiz all those guys. Tell them if they think any of these ideas are a good idea or they believe in any of this crap. The answer will be no, because those guys live in a world where if your ideas are bad, you get crushed by an I-beam.
Well, and if you're one of those people who works in the trades, I know that there have famously been examples of people who are bigots, and I'm sure that every human society since the beginning of time has had some form of bigotry based on something. I mean, it could be skin color, it could be all kinds of things, but I would imagine that today, if you find yourself hanging I-beams, you know, on a construction site, they don't so much care what color your skin is. What they care is whether or not you do the job and say, he's a good worker, he's a deadbeat. And it's not defined based on skin color. It's defined based on whether or not you're capable.
Every job works that way. No, everyone pretends like we're grafting all this stuff onto it. But you and I know that if you ask 1 million Americans the ethnicity of your Uber driver, you can get a red-haired guy. Looks like Johnny Whitaker from Escape to Witch Mountain, 1974. Or you can have a black man or an Asian or a Hispanic, and everything is the same, then everybody would just go flip a coin, who cares? If you said the Asian, black, or Hispanic Uber driver that picked you up was 1% better, they'd all just take them. That's our society. We're in a meritocracy. That's why we love sport.
I'm talking to Adam Carolla, who, along with Dennis Prager, created No Safe Spaces. Great movie. Now, one of the things you did was you tried to get some left-leaning folks in, and who better for that than Van Jones from what I call the Chicken Noodle News Network. But Jones says that even those these people who don't do things with their hands but did go to college and got a 4, 6, or 8 year degree, that they're not capable of defending their own values that they espouse?
Yeah, Van, who obviously we disagree with quite a bit politically,
okay.
Came on my podcast and, you know, it said, look, whatever we agree on or disagree on, we have to agree on free speech because that's the beginning of the end if we can't agree on that. And to his credit, that's what he espoused. You know, not everybody is all in on this stuff, which is becoming increasingly more difficult to support if that's your side. You know what I mean? I think you're going to end up sort of like the direction that California's going, which is like homeless and then ultra wealthy.
That's Adam Carolla. You should check out his podcast and, of course, the new movie, No Safe Spaces. It's a pleasure to have you with us, Adam. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com and tell your Alexa device to play the Lars Larson Show.